Good day, everyone. Welcome back to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Mappy Davis. It is Monday, the 31st, and I'm bringing to you yet another episode on this new but super-duper exciting podcast. Those of you that are tuning in, I appreciate you. Dare I say love you. Those of you that are telling your friends, I love you as well. Those of you that are recommending guests to me and connecting to guests, even I just love you. What can I say? This is a mutual situation. When I first started my previous podcast, it was just in a vacuum of OCR. I mean, I knew there were people out there listening, but there was a little bit of give and take. But now I really understand how this thing works, the way podcasting has sort of taken our whole society and culture. People love them. People like absorbing them. And it's a true dialogue between you and I, host and listener. So please keep giving me feedback. Leaving it on iTunes would be great. Again, much more importantly is you tell a friend. Much more important to me is that when you're talking to friends about podcasts, oh, what do you listen to? Oh, This American Life, blah, 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 Stuff You Should Know, blah, blah, blah. I'm sorry. I'm not doing a very good job right now. But I'm appreciating you, and we're on to something good here. My gut instinct, when my friend Steve French, who I've never mentioned, I don't think, on the show yet. Steve, thank you. Steve is the web guy, and when I wanted to launch this thing, I needed someone that could help me get it up on the web fast. I can do WordPress enough, but to launch this and do it right and deal with the bugs and blah, 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 I needed a good partner in this situation. And so Steve, boom. I know you since high school. Maybe one day you'll be on the show. Who knows? Maybe we'll do a special live thing or something. But I feel like in our very short time, we've got some very cool momentum with this thing, and it's on to something. So thank you, thank you, thank you for listening and for telling friends. On today's episode, Jason Hawk from How Stuff Works. I read an article recently, a podcasting article, which talked about how Atlanta was becoming a cool hub for podcasts. I had no idea that How Stuff Works has an office right here in Atlanta, right down the street, essentially, right down the Beltline, which is becoming sort of a running theme of this podcast, an early theme anyway, right down the Beltline at Ponce City Market. I reached out, he said we could talk, and so we did. As you know, I do not like to give you the play-by-play in the intro. That's for the intro that you've read, or just to enjoy during the listen. I will say that they had super cool offices, and as I say in the show, it would be, if someone gave me a bunch of money and said, design a cool, like, office where you've got some chill rooms, some conference rooms, some places to shoot content, some audio stuff to record, it's probably what I would build. You're also going to notice the sound on this episode is phenomenal, because that's the difference between sitting outside with my Zoom handy H4N recorder and two Shure microphones and the setup that we met over there. I thought about just using my regular microphones, but I thought, you know what? They've got this great studio. Let's use it. So it's going to sound really great. And part of me was like, oh, but then the other episodes won't sound as good. But you know what? Screw it. It sounded great, and we're making that happen. So let's dive in, man. Jason and I, me and Jason, just a few, what was it, like 6 days ago, I think. It was so darn good. We got it right into the pipeline. Away we go. I have to say, I'm going to say it in the intro, I'm sure, but I'm very conscious that this is going to sound considerably better. What it might do is just inspire me to get better equipment, I don't know, or to get a soundproof room. So that's my first thought actually walking through this whole space is like, this is like if somebody gave me a ton of money, what I would probably build, this really cool space to make really cool content.
You would be surprised how you can pull something like this off without having to spend a ton of money. Like I think your impression is probably like, wow, there's a lot of really great things here, but we didn't go overboard. We didn't go crazy. This is exactly what the team wanted, which is what I love, right? This is the equipment.
Like you're saying, they could have like gone like the tricked out Ferrari model.
Yeah.
And like gotten 10 rooms or the most expensive equipment. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Like just the good, reasonable soundproofing, the right equipment that's mainly computer-based, the right microphones without kind of saying, well, it's only good if I spent $5,000 on that microphone. that doesn't work for us. So we've been working on this stuff for years and know what works and doesn't work. And so I begged the team, buy what it is you feel is the best for our studio, and this is what we have. And we're really proud of it, but we didn't go crazy with it.
All right, so let's back up a little bit. You're from where?
What do you mean?
Okay. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah, I was a Midwestern boy.
Right. And what did you want to be when you grew up?
You know, there was no internet. I was actually thinking about going into politics. It was my background at University of Wisconsin-Madison was a political science and history degree. Almost hit a triple major with philosophy. But I didn't want to be a lawyer. And so I think there's been lots of talk about how in the world of technology and digital, critical thinking and kind of all the pieces to put it together have been key. And so I've been a digital native for over 20 years. And as change has happened, as thinking about the future has been a key every month, right? Every year, there's so much change. I've just tried to apply some of that critical thinking to whatever we're doing.
So what was, when you say 20 years, I'm trying to do the math. Is that the 90s?
Yeah, I was actually, so I moved to North Carolina in 93. And in 95, I worked at the Microelectronics and Supercomputing Center. And they had the Internet 2 backbone in 1995.
What does that mean?
So that means they had high-speed internet running through the university system, Chapel Hill, Duke, NC State, through this complex that was funded by North Carolina's state government. And I was running high-speed internet at my desk using Mosaic and Netscape. Before these things...
People what Mosaic and Netscape
are. Yeah, exactly. So they were the predecessors to Google Chrome and Firefox and Safari, Internet Explorer, the first browsers that were out there. Everything was, downloading at a crawl, except for me. And to be able to watch all this stuff happening so quickly without a dial-up was pretty stunning. And so learning how to code pages from scratch to kind of learning it from the ground up and having a technology appreciation, but also here's what we're going to do about it, was pretty incredible. Having a whole supercomputer building with Silicon Graphics O2 machines that you could play with and do 3D models was just this huge playground. Going to Internet World 95 in Boston and seeing the Yahoo guys, Dave Filo and Jerry Yang, staffing the booth, or Mark Andreessen at Netscape, showcasing the newest version of Netscape, or Adobe coming out with PageMill, which was the first of a series of tools that let you build web pages without having to code it from scratch. Crazy stuff. Lots of AOL disks sitting everywhere, too. And so just really, over time, building expertise and kind of being super thirsty for all that stuff has been a passion of mine.
Did you make your own, personal, GeoCities page?
Yeah, geocities.com/something or other.
Well, it was a neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
It was like these were virtual. We have to explain this to people who are, for our younger listeners. So before you could just throw up a WordPress site, there was this thing called GeoCities, and there were these virtual, quote-unquote, neighborhoods. So you would pick, are you a Hollywood guy? Are you Boston guy? And then it would be /, and then 1,000, was it numbers? I can't even remember.
Yeah, the whole series of things that when you look back... seem quaint and out of date, but also brings back some pretty fond memories of those days.
Right. Well, even 10 years ago, if you use the Internet Wayback Machine and you find websites, it's like the coolest website back then. It's kind of hilarious.
It also breaks your heart when you use the Wayback Machine and some of the old websites you worked on, you can't get access to, or they've changed, or they've taken them down. That's part of the history of building things. It's one thing to write a book and have that live in a library for 50 years.
Right.
It's another thing when your website changes, as it always will over the years. And you remember what you worked on, but it's always getting broken apart and put back together again in the newest version. So.
Yeah. And so what was the next move after that?
So I worked for a internet agency building websites. It was called Trinet Services, and we were eventually bought by another company called Interpath that kind of did the same thing. And I've always loved being close to content and media, and that's always just been a passion of mine. And I got a call from one of my cohorts out of the blue around 1998 or 99 that said, we are starting this company called Starport, and we are going to work with astronauts to help kids and students feel like they're traveling in space through virtual worlds and kind of all this crazy stuff. And some of our advisors are Buzz Aldrin and other astronauts.
Like real astronauts.
Real astronauts. Peter Diamandis of the XPRIZE was involved. Eric Anderson of Space Adventures, which was the crew that took Dennis Tito up to the space station as the first tourist. And on, some great big thinkers. And the technology wasn't there, but it was sure fun. It was sure fun thinking big about this experience. And we sold that business to space.com around 1999, and I worked for some version of space.com for about 6 or 7 years.
Well, even when you talk about creating content, it's hard for me to wrap my brain around it, because we think of content nowadays and we think social and we think, you know, all the, you know, anybody with an iPhone can fire up a camera. Is like, what, like stuff that was content based, you know, you talk about having the speed, but there just wasn't the content because nobody could watch it other than you,
right,
in the college. You know, you were waiting forever. It always stopped. You always had to download a new QuickTime player.
Yeah.
Right?
And there was things like at Starport and even Space.com, we have had an experience called Ask an Astronaut. And it was it's like yesterday's version of a Facebook Live or a Twitter session, right?
Right.
And it was, wow, I get to actually ask a question of an astronaut, and they actually replied. That was pretty groundbreaking for the time.
Sure. Okay, so where were we in the timeline there?
So space.com, founded by Lou Dobbs, and
Moneyline Lou Dobbs?
Yeah, absolutely. And we built the ultimate space destination. We built space.com.
He was just a guy that was interested in space?
Super interested in space. You know, raised some money from a variety of providers in the early 90s, and we continued to build that business out into other sites that most folks have heard of, like Live Science. .com and some others. We had Starry Night Software, which is an astronomy software experience. We bought Orion Telescopes a number of years later. So we really had this cool science and space-based business that was actually quite healthy and very fun to work in. And the kind of people that you interacted with, I'll never forget when the XPRIZE was going to be won. And the team out in the Mojave Desert had launched their vehicle. They had to send it out into space and bring it back in a period of a couple hours. And we actually had a board meeting at space.com that day. And I had to knock on the door and interrupt that meeting. And Neil Armstrong was part of our board.
Wow.
And they put it on the TV, and he gave us play-by-play.
Oh,
what
wow.
Was happening.
Oh,
and
wow.
I will never forget that. Neil's was a very humble, very nice, very sweet man. And I'll take that memory with me forever. Yeah, it's just incredible.
Wow. I mean, I'm almost like tearing up. That's like...
It really was. It was... I tell my kids about it.
Like when they learn about it in school, whatever, you're like, you know, we actually hung out with this guy and he was able to do...
Yeah, he cared too much about where we were going as a society and what space should mean for young individuals and what it meant to understand all the pieces of space. So it was incredible having him part of that team.
So have you hung out with Elon, I'm guessing, or no?
I wish. I was actually in 2000, it was 2004, 2005, I was actually part of the first commercial zero-G flight in the United States, right here out of Atlanta. They did a media tour. CNN and some other folks were part of the media tour too. And knowing Peter Diamandis, it was one of his companies that he had an offshoot called Zero-G. And Zero-G was really that experience that took you up in a plane. They flew us out of Hartsfield, Jackson here, out over the ocean, and we did parabolas. We did Martian and moon-based parabolas. And experience that.
So parabola is when they just, you go up and down really fast, and that's mm-hmm. what creates the weightlessness.
Yeah.
So I just learned on the WTF podcast, Kevin Bacon was on there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you listen to WTF. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you hear that one?
Uh-uh.
Okay. So Kevin Bacon talks about those scenes for Apollo 13, and that they were supposed to just use that to sort of get them ready. And then Ron Howard was like, let's just shoot that. And yeah. So they shot like a gazillion scenes, like literally in those.
I can't imagine how they pulled that off.
Right? Because it's like, what is it, 20 seconds at a time?
Yeah. It's not a long distance. And there's also just, you know, things you need to think about with regards to not getting turned around too quickly. And,
like not barfing, you mean?
Yeah. And you know, that was actually a really big deal. I think there's something that hangs over that is just not realistic. Like the way that you're taken care of, the way that you go up, and people aren't barfing all over the place. It's just not true. Like back in the days when NASA was doing this and they called it the vomit comet, I think that just kind of stuck in the lexicon of what we call that. But the reality is it's really fun. And if you've seen Martha Stewart do it or Stephen Hawking did it, they loved it. It was amazing. And
in the wheelchair he did it?
No, they actually picked him up, and it was joyful for him, right? He was able to experience pretty much the same thing that anyone that is able could experience in this free-floating atmosphere.
So how much attention do you still pay to all that stuff? I mean, I joked about knowing Elon or not, but do you pay close attention to this stuff?
I do, and I think now's a really cool time for space. It's really, for me, it's exciting because on the deep space discovery path, we see lots and lots of news about exoplanets, about things that we're trying to go further than ever before. We've got the James Webb telescope going up in a couple years. We went to D.C. and actually visited the facility and saw that being built, which is incredible here at HowStuffWorks. And then just kind of all the private stuff is exactly what has been needed. A little friendly competition between Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin and Elon Musk with SpaceX. It has everything to do with price. It has a little bit to do with ego. It has amazing visuals. So we're seeing, you know, these craft come back, land on a platform in the middle of the ocean, just things we've never seen before. And I think that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I mean, billionaires competing against each other, that's...
And just even when you go and you watch The Martian with Matt Damon or you watch some of these movies, you know, I tend to think, you know, we could actually pull that off one day.
Right. Did you say HowStuffWorks?
HowStuffWorks. Right here.
I might call this episode HowStuffWorks because that's legit what I thought. I was like, why did he say HowStuffWorks? Is that a nickname? Anyway, you're not finding it nearly as amusing as I am.
No, that's okay. I get it all the time.
Really?
It just people need to put it together. They're not thinking about it when they're hearing it. And yeah, all good.
I just think it's hilarious. Maybe that's a nickname you guys call it when people are, you know, people do that. They'll take their company and they'll the goofy name that people.
Yeah.
All right. So I've been dying to get to this. So we have to get straight to it now, which is how you ended up in the wrestling world.
So long story short. Well, first I was at HowStuffWorks in 2007
right.
And was brought on to build that and grow that. And a couple years into that, Discovery bought us, Discovery Communications, Discovery Channel, Animal Planet, all that good stuff, bought us for $250 million and tasked us with, you know, building amazing experiences from sharks to galaxies to everything.
Do you think they got it for a steal at $250
million? I don't know. That's a good question. Enjoyed my time there. We did the integration.
Are you not allowed to talk about that?
No, it's fine. No, I enjoyed it. I think there was a lot of promising things that still could have been done.
Okay.
And I think sometimes there's a lot of companies out there, not exclusive to Discovery, that are trying to understand, are they a TV company? Are they a digital company? If they're a hybrid of the two, what does that mean? Do you even talk about those things as two different experiences anymore? And I think in that 2009 to 2011 zone, there was a lot of questions. What content should we put up on a website? What video should we put up? What does it mean to have an on-demand experience? Now everyone expects their stuff to be on demand.
Of course.
And there's just a, it's a complicated business, and it's you know, we were in the midst of that.
So what were you brought on to do back then?
I ran the product team and the mobile experience for How Stuff Works and Discovery, which is super fun. Building all the cool stuff, and then kind of out of the blue, WWE called.
So they headhunted you.
Mm-hmm. And I moved my family up to Connecticut, and was just really excited about building something on such an amazing platform. If you know anything about WWE, they're incredible marketers. They
genius.
Genius. And I think they're getting the credit they've deserved now for that, but it's still kind of unheralded in what they do. And their approach to a full media onslaught of just reaching consumers where they are.
Right. Well, I want to get to all of that, because I have this new fondness, love for wrestling, which is why I'm so glad that I was already excited to talk to you about all this stuff and the digital world and podcasting, and then I look at your LinkedIn and I'm like, no way. So tell me what your first meeting with the man was like.
I would say Vince McMahon, of course. I love Vince. I think he's great. He's very curious. He really wants you to lean in and go all the way. What I really appreciated about him is he said, we want to...
Are we having some kind of warning?
It's just a test.
Okay.
We won't be able to hear that. We'll beep that. That was just a fire alarm.
No, I mean, even if it you don't think it's going to come through this, if no. It's okay.
Yeah, you won't be. Won't you start over?
I'm not going to. I do very little editing.
Okay.
I cut out the beginning and the end, but okay. You were explaining what Vince was like.
We had a fire alarm here, everyone.
If you're hearing this, we lived.
Yeah, that's right.
Please proceed.
He said, we don't want to be first, but we want to be right on the edge of the things that are mattering in people's lives. And that could be something a couple years ago. It could have been QR codes. It could have been Shazam. It could have been in-ring experiences, digital experiences. So there was an appreciation of taking it almost to the edge, but not quite, letting other people help you break new ground, but really being as close to that as possible. And what I really loved is he would really provide the support, the resources, the access to talent, and I would say that the talent, you know, there was an education process there too. And so actually spending time in front of a huge room of professional wrestlers, or superstars as they're called,
right,
and teaching them the ways of social media was both incredibly satisfying and a little bit daunting, because this was their brand. They didn't understand exactly how they should use it. They made mistakes sometimes. They didn't know what the rules were. So a lot of my role and the role of others was to provide best practices, to also inform Vince and the executive management team about where we were going with this. And through lots of people's work now, you know, that social media platform is getting, you know, over 200 million social followers, I think. They are the largest channel on YouTube. This is something Stephanie McMahon taught me. She said, you can't dictate the platforms that people are going to consume your content on. You have to listen to your fans and go where they're at and program content specific to those platforms, whether it's Instagram or Facebook or it's YouTube. And that was really telling. And so they dedicated the resources, and it allowed us to really reach a lot of new fans, a lot of energy. And, you know, we were able to drive people to the pay-per-views. We were able to get them excited and trend content on Twitter as they happened. We launched a YouTube Live experience the hour before a pay-per-view and showed a match and got people excited. And they programmed original stuff around it, and it drove subscribers.
Did you watch wrestling growing up?
I did.
Okay, so you were like me in the sort of original heyday, right? The Hulk Hogan
absolutely
day.
And you know, people, they tend to come and go as there's kind of a wave that happens where you grow up as a kid and then you get a little bit older, maybe high school or college age, you go off, raise a family, have your family, and then you bring it back with your kids. And that's exactly where I was at.
Yeah. So I am too. So I grew up, I watched every Saturday.
Yeah.
So here in Georgia, there was Georgia Championship Wrestling. There was still all the regional wrestlings. And then there was the, once in a while, you got Hulk Hogan on Saturday night instead of Saturday Night Live, right?
Yep.
And
Saturday night main event.
Saturday night main event, sorry. Yep. And I'd completely forgotten about wrestling, like completely forgotten about it. So I met this gentleman, Charles Robinson, who's a ref.
Yeah, he's great. We actually talked to him for a feature we did a couple years ago.
Why would I not think you don't know him? I got to take a picture. I got to take a picture with him and we'll send it to him. So,
okay.
So it turns out he's an obstacle racer. And we met, and he said, you know, come down to the match. And I went to, so this is a year ago, December. My son had not watched wrestling. Maybe he knew who Cena was, but it wasn't like he was watching it every Saturday like I was. And we went, and instantly he cheered for the good guys. He booed the bad guys. He was fucking into it.
Yeah.
And like it brought it all back for me, and just sort of, I was just sort of impressed, right? And then it's gotten, I thought it was all pay-per-view. Like, I didn't even know how it worked. I didn't know that it's on every Monday and Tuesday night.
Yeah, and then they have a whole WWE Network, which is a digital subscription service, actually very groundbreaking in terms of access to the library, on-demand content a la Netflix, and lots of exclusives. And so it's, they first started in the U.S., they built it out internationally, and that business is doing quite well.
Well, I was already, like, I'd been to a couple matches, and then we drove down to Columbus a couple weeks ago, and we had ringside. And I want to tell anybody, I've been to a lot of events, a lot of concerts, you need to sit front row at a wrestling match because they will land on you.
Yeah.
And it's just unbelievable. I mean, I'm such a fan now, and like, it doesn't take too long to catch up on the previous stories. Like, what they do a really good job of now is, even on the regular weekly shows, they show what happened in the last pay-per-view, kind of keep you caught up. Here's what I wanted to ask you, because as a kid, I guess I was, I'm not sure if it was sophisticated or not, because it seems like now, like, how do you draw, and you're, I think you would know, did you see Glow?
I've seen a little bit.
Okay. Well, spoiler alert, at the end of Glow, he says, like, the money's in the chase, right? It's not just about this one match, right? So how does one draw storylines that last years or decades?
That's it. It's stories. And it's being true to those stories. It's understanding character evolution. It's also listening to the fans. And so part of that isn't set in stone. If you think someone's going to get a pop when they go out there and instead they get boos, that is actually exciting. If you get nothing, that's not good. And so the ability to generate excitement on both ends, both on the hero end, if you will, or the villain end, and ability to drive that story and then know when that story should wind down is an important part of that, whether it was 20, 30 years ago or today. And it's all about characters, and a lot of those characters are meant to be a reflection of our society, a little bit more overstated, and so it invokes a certain emotion when that happens.
Well, and again, I know you're not there now, but, you know, we're talking about wrestling, so it's funny. That was like, I try to explain to people, like, that's the thing with podcasts is, like, I don't need to say, we're sitting here today with Jason, because I've done that on the front end. And, like, you know, on the radio, every 5 minutes they come back to break, we're speaking with Jason Hawk today. I don't need to do that. We're speaking about wrestling. Is that, you know, when we were kids and it was Hulk Hogan versus Nikolai Volkov, right? And so you've got the current champion is a guy named Jinder Mahal, mm-hmm. who's not American.
Right.
And I feel like it's a little scary. Like, I'm looking at the eyes of the fans, like, most people, like, will yell something to the villain or the heel, you suck, and then they kind of smile when he yells back. But I don't know. It's a little scary. Like, I guess I'm kind of surprised that he's giving the sort of, you know, puny American speech in 2017.
But this is, it's just classic storytelling. So even though we're 25, 30 years later, a lot of those core principles still apply. Yeah.
So are you frightened at all? Like, do you think that maybe it's, I don't know, kind of Trump rally-ish is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I think it taps into very much of a base of the way even our country works, for sure.
I can't tell if you're being measured or this is just how you are.
I'm being measured.
Okay.
To each his own.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and that's the other thing I want to talk about is Charles was nice enough to bring us backstage before the event to meet some of the guys and gals. And first of all, they're all completely gracious, totally get that the kids are where it's at.
Yep.
And then to see them come out in character was even more impressive. Yeah. Because, you know, it's not massive changes, but just the hair and their attitude or their mannerisms. And then here, and they're these, it's funny, I was saying to people that in person, most of them seem like, oh, you don't look as big. But then when they come out, they are effing larger than life.
Yeah.
The music, the pomp and circumstance. And that's the other thing is that, you know, now everybody's got a song and a massive graphic. That wasn't the case when we were kids, right?
Well, that's right. So that's the whole experience. It's not just what they're wearing or what they look like, but it's this massive video board. It's they have their own theme music. They will probably present their own Twitter handle or social following, right? And so it really builds that energy for sure. And that it's amazing. You need to go to WrestleMania sometime. And I'm imagining that they're probably going to be back here at Mercedes-Benz at some point.
Right.
But it takes it to a whole new level when you're walking backstage and you see, because it's celebrities too. Like
celebrities?
Celebrities.
Celebrities.
So you'll see when I was in Miami for WrestleMania 28, P. Diddy was there, spent some time with Mike Tyson, and it's larger than life. And so, like, let's make an experience that is so entertaining that you can't stop talking about it. You can't stop thinking about it. And this is just something magical for an adult or a child.
Yeah, and that's what I've started to reach out to people that I knew were wrestling fans. Like, I'd seen them mention it on Facebook or whatever, and I've started messaging them being like, oh, I totally get it. And they all say the same thing. Got to go to WrestleMania. Now, this year it's New Orleans, or
yep.
2018 it's New Orleans,
yep.
Which makes it somewhat doable because it's not too far to travel. Yeah. But in the back of my mind, knowing we just built this Enormo Dome, we're probably going to get it soon,
yeah.
And I can wait until it comes here. I think that's probably what I'll do.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, even just watching when they show some of those video packages and you see a sold-out football stadium with 70,000 people and fireworks. And so is it that – I guess is that a way to think about it? Like the storylines are like year chunks, like WrestleMania to WrestleMania, and then sort of smaller stories in between?
Yeah, so they typically run on a year cycle building towards WrestleMania. And then you have between 10 and 12 pay-per-views, of which – you've got four cornerstones. WrestleMania is one, SummerSlam, Survivor Series, and I can't think of the last one. I'll think of it. But there's four that are the big ones that are the larger than life events that they make a bigger deal out of.
How much do you pay attention now or go to events?
It depends. My kids are getting a little bit older. We're running around like crazy, and but I'm still a fan, and still keep in touch with a lot of the folks there. I'll make you jealous right now.
Okay.
To tell you that about a year and a half ago, we had Ric Flair in the studio here.
Which seat did he sit in?
He was in the other studio.
Oh man.
He was doing some voiceover work.
Yeah.
And for a show called Camp WWE, which is an animated series. And he's larger than life. Yeah,
well,
he's amazing.
I mean, you talk about the man. I mean,
he's 30 minutes outside of the city, so.
He is?
Yeah, he is.
I might have to reach out to him or his people. Yeah, I won't even ask you for the introduction. Maybe I'll talk to Charles.
Yeah, he's great.
So Charlotte became immediately my favorite female wrestler just for that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, she's doing the strut. And I mean, she did that entrance cartwheel right in front of me. And I was like, what the hell? Even though I'd seen it before, it just happened right in front of me. And I was like, oh, my God.
There's a ton of.
I want to marry this woman.
Just the athleticism
is
incredible. And so even when you're in the ring, it's a lot harder than it looks.
Well, that's the thing that's when you're watching it live, right? Even if once in a blue moon, which is really what it is, and I've being front row, you can't be much closer, you see something not connect. There's so much physicality happening regardless, and it's live, so they could miss and they don't. Yeah. You know, backflips off the top rope and throwing each other out of the ring, and like I said, like literally landing on you. And I'm a fan. So listen, if you have kids, like you can't think of a reason to go to a wrestling match, but you have kids. My son is 8. He's beyond thrilled with going. So take your kids.
One thing I'll add is we were lucky enough, just because I kept up with the WWE team when they were here in Atlanta a couple years ago, and they were having a SmackDown show at Phillips Arena. I asked if we could film the WWE experience, meaning all the stuff you don't see. And so they took us up on it, and we were able to interview a lot of the superstars, but also show the construction of the arena, including the ring. And we also got under the ring, and so Charles was actually part of that process.
Right.
He got under the ring with us, and the turnbuckles and everything. And it was pretty amazing. It was probably one of the most popular videos we've ever done.
What's it called?
How the WWE experience works. It's on YouTube.
Well, I will say I will put it in the show notes, but A, half the time I don't remember, and B, I actually call the show notes that nobody reads, because I'm sure they do for these guys, because yeah. It's all about nerdiness and finding out why stuff works.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in my experience, not a lot of people do. Yeah. In my experience.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I even talk to other podcasters and we talk about it, and I say, how often do you go to show notes for other shows? They're like, never. I'm like, all right, people probably aren't reading yours. But again, your guys are slightly different.
Part of it's the scale. So we're speaking to the big fans who want everything that we can put out there.
Right. Yeah. So let's talk about that. Because one of my experiences with podcasting specifically is that it's this awesome passive thing, right? You can ride a bike. Some people can actually do work. I can't. I'm too like ADD for that. But like mow the lawn, go for a run, your morning drive, right? All of that stuff. And so then to get them to then do something different is an additional step. Go to this show note, watch this thing. So again, I know specifically for your show, they're kind of geeking out on all that stuff. But do you understand sort of the stretch that it is for a lot of people?
Yeah, I think even if we deep dive on a topic, let's say for 45 minutes, we know that we have not read the encyclopedic version of it. Like, right. That's not what we do. We try to be curious explainers. Even if we didn't know about something, we've learned it as much as we can, and we have fun telling that story. But we know that there's kind of a lot of things that maybe we couldn't talk about that people want to dive deeper on. And so you get a portion of the audience that appreciates kind of whether it's the resources that we pulled or additional things that they can explore because they're really curious on that topic. Yeah, we found it plays pretty well.
Do you have a lot of angry, this is not how this works and this is how it really works, people that reach out to you?
Sometimes. and that's actually part of the fun too. We just did a replay of How the Sun Works for Stuff You Should Know, which is kind of goes down in the coffers as one of those most famous episodes of all time where you try to explain how the sun works, and there's all kinds of pretty smart people out in the world paying attention to that. And so they've had fun even mentioning that show over and over again for years because they realized just how hard it was to explain it. But they know where they stand. I mean, I think people got what they were trying to do.
So when you talk about, you know, we did the tour of the building and all these various places that you produce content. So how many shows do you have?
So we have 14. So we have podcasts. We have 14 shows.
Right.
We produce around 40 to 50 hours of original audio a month. I think that number will double in the next year as we launch new shows.
Right.
We have in our library over 6,000 episodes that we built over 8 or 9 years.
Wow.
That's 3,000 hours of audio.
Wow.
And Stuff You Should Know, and this applies to a lot of our shows, it's coming up on its 1,000th episode this October or November. And they're just getting started. And so
he says with a big smile.
Yeah, no, it's really fun. And so part of our approach is in some ways evergreen content creation, so that as the podcast industry has grown up and a lot of folks have come on the platform, people have the ability to certainly listen to a new episode, but they can also listen to an episode from 3 or 4 years ago and appreciate it just as fresh as when it was produced originally. And we hear a lot of folks are binge listeners. Like, get started, and there's a little bit of a badge of honor.
Like, I've listened to every episode.
Yeah. Like, go and listen to 900-some episodes and brag about that.
I had a friend who years ago said he was going to do This American Life from zero to finish, and I was like, that's impressive. He's probably done it by now. I should check in with him.
Well, think about people that have, you know, maybe an hour commute each way, or, like, it's just, you know, think of what Howard Stern has said for years. That morning or afternoon commute is the most miserable part of most people's day.
Right.
And he has always been about, like, let's make it more fun.
Right.
And so podcasts, here's another opportunity, whether you're in your car or on the subway or walking to work, here's a way to kind of connect and release in a really unique way.
Right.
And it's magical.
Well, I was going to talk about television competitors, but actually let's specifically talk about terrestrial radio. Once upon a time, you were listening to Howard Stern or not. Podcasting, I can listen to you. I can listen to Marc Maron. I can listen to This American Life.
Yeah.
Who do you consider competition, or do you even think about that?
I think the industry, we've actually gotten pretty excited and in talking to other folks that I've known for years. We're supportive of each other. In fact, we do sometimes audio promo trades with NPR or Midroll or any variety of companies to promote our shows on each other's shows, because we feel like there's a lot of energy around the growth of this industry, but we need to do a whole lot more to make it even bigger. And we're excited about the numbers, we're excited about the scale and the growth, but kind of collectively, we want this to get to a whole nother level. Add another zero to everything, if you will, in terms of audience engagement.
And that's possible. There's still room for that to happen.
Yeah, there's a ton of opportunity. We think that it's certainly clicking with young people. We've seen a shift from desktop to mobile, obviously, over the years. It used to be a desktop experience, if you remember, right? Mm-hmm. You had to get iTunes, hook up your iPod, sync it all up, and then you're ready to take it with you.
I had an assistant who had to show me that, which is now a watermark in my life.
Yeah.
Because I had a different business, and I wanted to listen to Marc Maron, and I said, can you teach me how to do this?
Yeah.
And as she was showing me, I thought, people used to ask me how to program the VCR, and now I'm the guy asking some young person how to upload a podcast.
Well, and now LTE networks and Wi-Fi, like, to download a, you know, it could be a 15 or 60 meg file is no big deal as you're walking down the street.
Right.
So you can actually do that anywhere.
Right.
And so I think there's a lot of things that have driven that growth or that success. Actually, Apple investing and saying podcast is its own app. It's not hidden in iTunes anymore.
I know, but I can't call it anything but iTunes. Where do you stand on this great debate?
I mean, they've actually rebranded everything as Apple Podcasts in a big way over the last couple months. They've really leaned into that.
And how do you feel about it?
I think it's great.
I'm always going to call it iTunes.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like when the Raiders left Oakland. Yeah, my dad was like, they're the Oakland Raiders. They're not the LA Raiders.
You know, and then you see things like Spotify, which is a massive streaming platform, and they're playing around with podcasts and how it fits in the overall discovery experience, and on and on and on. And so it's been pretty exciting, but there's a lot of opportunity. So there's a lot of, so we look at, you know, maybe our demographic, 40s and above. There's growth, but there's room for more growth and programming for that audience. And the other thing that's still a little bit of a head scratcher for me is Android. I don't believe that podcasts have properly served the Android market.
I cannot find my podcast on the Google Play Store on my iPhone. I don't.
Google Play Music is on every phone on Androids, and it's kind of buried in a bigger experience.
Well, do you think it's like, is that some sort of retaliation against iTunes? Or, like, it doesn't make sense now that I think about it. Why would they want to make it harder?
I think all these companies are figuring it out.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out what that means. And it's also got to remember that, you know, these big platforms look at what are the opportunities of these things to be billion-dollar plus businesses. Like, where do we put our investment as a Google or a Spotify or an Apple? How big can this be?
Right. And it's not 2000, you know, 8 or 12. Like, yeah. We are where we are. So yeah. I guess it's kind of surprising to me, kind of like it's kind of surprising to me that I hear the same ads over and over again, like the same five companies, yeah. Casper and ZipRecruiter and whatever the three other ones that are on every single one. Like, I don't even count Audible because that's kind of a no-brainer. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, why aren't more companies figuring this out?
All right. So if you'll indulge me on this, this is a really interesting and important topic for where we're at right now.
Okay.
And I'll get a little bit geeky, but if you think there's some big changes happening in the podcast industry that most people won't even pick up on. One is that those ads you're hearing in the MP3 file that you're downloading used to have to be hard-coded, and they stayed there forever. So a lot of the podcasts that we produced back in 2012 still said the 2012 Toyota Corolla.
Right.
And it was stuck there forever.
Right.
And we did a pretty major overhaul of everything that we had now that the technology was there. So we have a dynamic ad serving platform that allows us to deliver ads in essentially real time as people download a new podcast.
Just like Pandora does.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're able to, you know, monetize our back catalog, which is huge, but also, you know, do a lot more of those things that you're used to hearing about in video and websites as far as, you know, running ads. Great. So that's one big change. The other is analytics. So what's actually happening? What are people actually listening to? So if WWDC, which is Apple's developer conference, recently they announced a pretty big upgrade to their analytics platform that has been kind of only telling you things like downloads and subscribers, but you weren't really actually knowing where people were listening, if they were skipping over ads, et cetera. And so we're going to get more data. And that data about listener habits, about how deep into a show people are listening, are they skipping the ads, et cetera, is really critical for the evolution of the types of advertisers that you're going to hear embrace the platform. So the advertisers you mentioned, they've stuck with it because it's a conversion game. It is, if I spend X, what do I get out of it?
Right.
And podcasts have been extremely effective, way over-indexed a lot of the other platforms in terms of direct response. And so they keep investing in that. It makes sense. The live reads, the host reads, the endorsements all make sense. It's really nicely integrated. But to truly take that to the next level and get the big brands understanding what it means to play in this space, they need more data. And the industry has not been good enough in explaining what a download is, what a listen is, what a subscriber is, what's actually happening. Did I get my ad heard or not? And so I feel like all these changes happening now allow us to speak a little bit of, you know, kind of a better approach to these agencies who really want to do this, but they're really not sure what they're walking up to. And so more data and being armed with a lot of technology investments that are happening, the data and the analytics is a super powerful piece of this.
Yeah, my understanding was that they didn't care at all. Like, we're this big platform, we'll push what we push. And once upon a time, you had to do some weird Google, some feed, right, with the RSS feed into some, I forgot what it was called back then. And then now you've got to use your player, your Burberry, your Libsyn, or whatever you're uploading. But I can't, as far as I know, I can't get any information from Apple.
Yeah, I think you will be able to.
Like, maybe you can because of the giganticness of your network?
Yeah. That's a great question.
But like, do you have a special phone line into, you know, wherever they are, Menlo or whatever they are in California, that other people, I'm not asking you to give it to me. I'm just asking.
Yeah. So we've known the Apple team for years, and here's what I'd say to anyone that is creating podcast content. If you dig hard enough, you can easily find the people that are actually right on the front lines and programming the editorial. You can find them. And they're looking for up-and-comers, emerging. They don't just care about the big stuff. If you go to the Apple podcast experience, you're going to find somewhere between 140 and 180 shows featured on their main page. That doesn't include category pages. So they're actually programming, have an editorial team that are really thinking about what are the big shows that are coming out, you know, from the NPRs and Missing Richard Simmons and kind of all that stuff, ESPN, 30 for 30, how stuff works, and then really trying to appreciate some of the other players and other voices, whether it's technology or science or whatever those categories are.
Well, here's what's great. I mean, and the reason why many people start podcasts, and if you're thinking of starting one, here's the really good news. You can be on iTunes, I want to say in about a minute. I think it takes a couple of hours. Once upon a time, I think it took a couple of days.
Yeah.
If you do everything right, if you type in the right categories, and which is it isn't much if yeah. someone like me can figure it out.
Yeah.
And then you can show, like this Atlanta podcast, we're already starting to show up in search, and I know, except on the Google thing, but and I know that because we're going to continue to do what we do, and we're going to do it well and consistently, we'll be at the top. Because most of the shows right now are old, and do they ever talk about, like, will they ever just wipe anything off? Or if somebody hasn't produced a show in 20 years, it's still going to live there?
Still lives there.
All right.
Because they're actually not hosting that. They're still pulling from your feed.
Oh, so it doesn't even take up any space, you're saying?
So if you're, what I'm saying is, whatever you've got set up right now or whatever we have set up, whether we're running on a cloud service or whatever, that's where it stays. Some providers actually download the files on the onto their own platform, the MP3 files, but Apple does not do that. So they're still looking every time at your RSS feed.
What do you think about all these players that I didn't even know existed until I get Google notifications, like from my other podcast, for the Obstacle Racing Media podcast? Once in a while, it'll be Podtastic, Podbay, all these things that are essentially just scraping iTunes. But I don't know, what is their eventual game? Do they think they'll sell ads? Like, what are they trying to do?
I'm not sure. I think there's a lot. There's, even though I said there was, you know, 180 or so podcast featured, you know, on their homepage, there's something like 300,000, 350,000 podcasts that are out there right now. And one of the complaints that I've heard is discovery. How do I get this discovered? There's no kind of one good place to go to find the niche podcast I'm looking for. Et cetera, et cetera. And so I think there's still some work to be done there.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's one of the things about people say, well, how can I get into the new and noteworthy? And they think, well, if I upload 10 episodes at once, I can maybe do that. And that's not really true, right?
No.
Okay.
One of the things, this gets to some of the best practices that I would ask people to think about. I would say that consistency of release time or release date is important. So like Tuesdays at noon, Thursdays at noon. Sometimes, and that goes for, don't take 2 weeks off. Don't take 3 weeks off. Stick to a schedule. It's kind of like blogging, you know. You put that first post out there, that second post is really hard to come up with. Just stay focused. We found that sometimes putting two episodes out a week for a show does better than one, because it builds kind of a energy and an algorithm of new and old or classic episodes. And then things like art really matter. Really matter. Like making this look great on a little tiny thumbnail, but also the kind of big album cover art. All those things are super important. Attention to detail. What does this mean? Can I explain it? Do I know what it's about? Have you put a promo out before you launch your show? Like, sometimes people want to learn about the show without downloading the first episode. And so one of the best practices from Apple and others is, give us a 2-minute clip. What are you all about? Let people kick the tires a little bit. Tell them when your first episode's coming out, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, see, I'm a bigger fan of just friggin' launch.
Yeah.
Like, just like my first episode, I was like, here we go.
Yeah.
And that's just how I chose to do it. Because, I don't know, I feel like a lot of times when they do those things, it's just some guy talking to a mic for 5 minutes, and it you know what I mean? If I can't tell from the title and the description, that's how I feel.
Yeah.
But I'm not everybody.
And so they're actually building some of that So when I talked about a promo episode, they're changing up the way the feeds are going to be set up. So there's going to be a lot of new experiences that you can play with on your phone, but also as a publisher, you can kind of create. So here's a couple examples. One is when I walk up to a show, the promo introduction's in its own area, right?
It's
not buried at the bottom.
That's smart.
Which is the next point I'm going to make, which is there's a lot more episodic stuff, meaning a season. I talked about Richard Simmons, which is a 10-episode season, or a Serial or S-Town.
Right, because otherwise it's backwards. You finish listening, and then the next one starts, which is the one before it. And who was the first one to do that? That I was finally like, who took them so long? Was it S-Town or Richard Simmons? One of those did it first.
Yeah.
They actually put it in the right order so that the next one was episode two instead of...
Yeah, I know. I don't remember who it was, but they're going to give you additional meta that you can add to your feed.
Meta.
Meta is so meta. And put it in the right
order. And I know it's an option, right? But most people aren't that complicated. I know it's an option, newest first, oldest first.
Yeah.
I didn't know that until recently, and I'm a podcast consumer. But again, like if you're going to launch a series, it only makes sense that it would be...
Yeah.
In order.
Yeah, so they're just giving you a couple more tools to be able to kind of tell the story in the way you want to do it.
Well, this is great.
Yeah.
I should start asking you stuff because you clearly like know. Like if I hear some rumor, I should ask you because you're clearly... So when you said they're not that hard to find, I know people at Apple, and as nicely as possible, I'll say that to me, they all act like they're working at Fort Knox. Like they'll never tell you anything because what they're doing is so important.
Well, this is true. I didn't see the analytics announcement coming. Or the meta tag announcement coming. And, you know, we just produce great content, hopefully, that people like. And we've been asking for certain things. And just this is something I think about a lot, too. There is a perception, whether it's Apple or other players, that this happens all the time. Let's think about Facebook or Twitter or Apple. A lot of times they're not huge teams. Like, I think there's a perception that, well, there's 1,000 people working on Apple Podcasts.
Right.
That's not true. They're relatively small teams on the front end, the marketing and communication end, working with partners and publishers. The development staff is not always going to be huge for specific products or apps. And it's, you know, they only have so much bandwidth, too. So part of it is... There certainly is a Fort Knox secrecy to it. I get all that. But there's also just so many resources. And I know that runs counter to what most people think.
All right. So you have a short commute.
Yes.
When do you listen to podcasts?
Gosh, whenever I can. I will actually intentionally. I'm 2.5 miles from work here. And if it's not god-awful hot, 95 degrees, I will actually walk to work and listen to a full episode here and a full episode back. With our shows, I tend to go in waves. I like to store them up. So like Stuff You Should Know, the guys know this. I'll let about 2 months buffer build up, and I'll be in a really good mood to just binge listen.
Right.
And then I'll take a couple months off. So I like to kind of stack them up.
Right. And when you're not listening to stuff from here, what are you listening to?
I love 30 for 30, the podcast.
See, I've not listened to any of those, and I'm a huge 30 for 30 fan, as most...
Just came out. They're
different stories than the visual stories.
Yes.
Okay.
It's really great. Jody Avergan put this together, and it's amazing. They announced it last year, and they came up with their first 5 episodes. The first one was on Dan and Dave, if you remember.
Yeah, what I saw. I was like, oh, I remember that.
It's really great. I just finished listening to one on kind of a card counting... scam in Vegas, which is fascinating. And, you know, I think sports is an underserved opportunity in podcasts where you see a lot of either just people as fans of teams that will have discussions on podcasts and kind of have kind of a local flair to the Green Bay Packers, Atlanta Falcons, whatever. Or you're going to see a lot of things taken from TV, like Pardon the Interruption or those things, and they just become audio.
Right.
And what I love about 30 for 30 is it was designed for this platform. It is original. It's unique. It's high production. And at the end of the day, it's about the story. And I don't feel like there's enough of those kind of storytelling experiences in the sports arena in podcasts. And I'm a huge sports fan, so I want to see more of that.
What, so you grew up a Packer fan?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what would you say to someone that says, well, why don't you film all these podcasts, throw them up somewhere just because it's an additional eyeball, even if it's not many?
Part of that is you know, I think part of that is just comfort level with the hosts. Not everyone likes to be filmed.
Right.
Listen, when you're listening to one of our shows, most of these are done pretty clean, but we're also perfectionists, and I think we want the end product to look, to sound great, to feel like it was really easy. Like, I don't want people, I don't want them thinking about the fact that Holly Fry, one of our hosts for Stuff You Missed in History Class, spent 20 hours researching it. What I want them to think about is, wow, that was an amazing 35 minutes about Lucille Ball or about Queen Victoria. Like, what an amazing story. How did Holly do this? And they leave with this great appreciation.
I'm not saying it has to be live. I just meant as another view. So you can say, not only are we getting all these downloads, but people watched it on YouTube.
Yeah. Jonathan Strickland, our host of Tech Stuff, has been doing some stuff with Twitch. It's gone okay. Our numbers are so big, though, that we don't have to do all those extra things. You know, we're doing over 35 million downloads a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
What does Like This American Life do?
So we're second biggest in the world right now.
Behind
NPR.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dude.
With only 14 shows.
Dude.
Yeah.
And you're gonna bring out even more content.
Yeah. So a couple bits of exciting news as we invest in this space is we really want this to be the home for great content creators. So I've known Will Pearson and Mangesh Hatikadar, who were the founders of Metal Floss magazine. I've known them for years. They founded the magazine in 2002 out of the dorm room in Duke University. Very much sit in a similar space as How Stuff Works. And I've known them for 10 years, and there was an opportunity to have them come on board. And so they joined us earlier this year, and they launched a show called Part-Time Genius. And I love it. It's great. They put a couple episodes out per week. And it's them having a complimentary but also different voice to our overall show slate. And then we're going to start getting into other genres, too. So we announced about 6 weeks ago, Jack O'Brien, who is the founder of Cracked.com.
I think I read that.
Yeah, and their main editor. He's opening or starting a comedy wing for us.
That's so cool.
Out of L.A.
That's what I read, that there's an L.A. office happening.
Yeah, we're working on building out a studio there, which is really exciting because it opens up a lot of, outside of the two or three shows that he's developing, it opens up a lot of opportunities to tap into talent out in L.A. too.
Right. Well,
and on and on.
Well, to quote my man Tony in PTI, like, we'll get you out of here on this, because this is the Atlanta podcast. And as I say to my audience, sometimes it's super in the weeds about Atlanta, sometimes it's not. Did you listen by chance? If you didn't, my feelings will not be hurt. Do you listen to like Ryan Gravel, for example?
I haven't had time.
Okay,
I'm behind on my own stuff.
All right. Well, so like the Ryan Gravel, you know who he is. Mm-hmm. He's the Beltline guy. So clearly that was an episode a lot about Atlanta. And some are just people I find interesting, it goes where it goes. So let's ask that question and get you out of here on that. So why are we here? Why is the studio not in New York or Los Angeles? Or this building?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've really built this organically over the years. And I felt about when I came back to How Stuff Works in 2000, I guess it was 14, I went down to the Metro Chamber of Atlanta, and I said, we're this big, awesome media brand that no one knows about. And I'm serious that like people have searched for us, they've heard about our podcast, but there was no identity of who we were and where we were. And so I gave them a big fancy presentation, and I told them all the numbers and where we were going. And that really started a conversation about how we can kind of use Atlanta to build a base of amazing talent, to, you know, kind of work with leadership groups across this great city. And we've just found amazing opportunities from helping program all the digital stuff at South by Southwest a couple years ago in the Choose ATL house, to kind of all sorts of things that we're really plugged into now. Atlanta's meaningful and important. And as we grow this team, you know, I feel like having Georgia Tech and Georgia State and kind of all these great universities in our backyard, it's actually a great talent, place for us to be able to recruit young people to come on and be video producers or audio engineers or editors or researchers or writers. And there's been a lot of dialogue and conversation about talent shortages in New York and DC and LA for this kind of stuff. And for Atlanta, I just don't buy it. I feel like there's a wealth of people that are crushing it, that we look for multifaceted people who understand digital and social and kind of are comfortable with video. And they're native to this, like I was 20 some years ago. And so we really want to tap into that enthusiasm and expertise and really help people grow their career here. And I'm all about it. And so when we made the move to Ponce City Market from Buckhead, it was as much about refreshing our identity and being in the middle of stuff as it was putting on a better consumer face, being one of those iconic brands here in Atlanta and doing some big stuff. And, you know, we did a trivia night here with the Atlanta Science Festival in March, and the thing sold out in 2 days. We had a line an hour before the event that was 200-300 deep, and just people love what we do. And we're going to shout out who we are and why Atlanta matters, period. And that's not going to stop.
That is awesome.
I think so, too.
So, go ahead.
And I was just going to say, and all the extra stuff about how people live, how they work, how they eat downstairs, how they commute. It's just not me that this is important to.
Right.
It's people like Allison that we met earlier. She biked to work. Like, that's part of the expected lifestyle or the lifestyle that people want to live and how they balance life and work. And some days this place is completely stuffed full of people. Sometimes it's empty because people need to work on scripts from home and they need some flexibility. And that's kind of part of the culture and environment that we're trying to foster. And it's made a whole lot easier by everything happening around here.
That's it. And that's all for this episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. As I mentioned, please do tell a friend. Also, drop me a note, mattbdavis@icloud.com. Maybe you're already friends with me on Facebook. If not, you can drop me a note there. Once upon a time, it was hard to find messages from strangers, people you weren't friends with. Not anymore. Facebook finally figured that out. Boom. Pending requests, whatever the hell it says. Drop me a note on the Facebook. I am on all platforms as Matt B. Davis. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. What really else is there? At least those platforms. So I'm super easy to find there. About me, I'm on the About Me page. Don't write me there. I'm not sure where those go. However, do tell a friend. Do leave us one of those reviews on iTunes. And let me know what you think of the show. Let me know any future guests you might want to have on the show. Or maybe you know somebody super cool that nobody knows that should be interviewed. Thank you so much for listening. Gotta run.